You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher. Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, a weekly series that brings you exclusive, in-depth conversations with some of the most interesting and exciting figures in hip-hop. We're brought to you by RapGenius.com, your source on the internet for decoding, annotating, and analyzing rap lyrics. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This week, we bring you an incredible three-part interview with one of the founding figures of hip-hop, Abiodun Oyewole of The Last Poets. Formed in 1968, The Last Poets mixed black power, radicalism, poetry, and drum beats to create a unique hybrid that would exert a huge influence on rap as we know it. Their powerful poems such as New York, New York, Gash Man, Jones Coming Down, and more are classic examinations of revolution, race, society, drug abuse, and other crucial issues of the time. The group's 1970 debut album was sampled by Biggie Smalls, N.W.A., and countless other rappers. In addition to his work with The Last Poets, which continues today, Abiodun has recorded several solo and collaborative albums, written books of poetry, and authored plays. The most notable of these, which we discussed at length, is Comments, a response to Entezaki Shange's classic 1975 play for colored girls who have considered suicide when the rainbow is enough. We began our talk with Abiodun by discussing his difficult-to-pronounce name, which the poet, who was born Charles Davis Jr., took at 15 upon discovering the Yoruba religion. So, I'm here with Abiodun Oyewole from The Last Poets.
Yep.
And it's, did I get it right? The
pronunciation? You got it exactly correct.
That's how they say it on Holy Terror, so I figured that was probably pretty close.
Yeah, well, and if you heard Holy Terror, then you heard me actually say my name.
Yeah.
Because I do the invocation.
Do the intro, yeah.
And it's so funny, it's a pleasure to hear you say my name correctly, because yesterday, I'm a member of a real fraudulent group, I'm going to say this, it's called the History Makers. Now, they've got about 500 so-called artists who go into the schools to try to motivate our kids all across the country. I think even in Hawaii and Alaska. And you know, you have to meet with the kids. I mean, they make a whole day of this history maker in the school. Yeah. So my day was Friday at the school. The jacket I'm wearing is actually Ebbets Field Middle School, because that was what the kids, that's what the school gave me after my day with them.
Yeah.
But it was an entire day. I spoke to the sixth grade. Then right after sixth grade, I had a chance to catch my breath for a minute. And then I spoke to the seventh grade. And after the seventh grade, I caught my breath a minute. Then I spoke to the eighth grade. And you know, middle school kids are crazy. They are out of their minds.
Yeah.
And, but I love them because I know they're betwixt and between. They were in that position where they are not quite sure if they want to be kids, and they know they want to be adults, and so they're really kind of in that middle period. So we had a wonderful time, but the person that introduced me was a person I taught with the City College, Dr. Oliver Patterson, and his daughter is the assistant principal at the school. So she had gotten, unbeknownst to me, she got her father to be the person to bring me on.
Oh.
And I thought that was really nice because I hadn't seen him in a long time.
Yeah.
So when we saw each other, it was like all home week. It was like, yeah, man, what you doing, Dr. Patterson? And so, but it's so funny. I've known him for a long time, maybe at least 20 years, and he's never, ever said my name correctly. Abio Dune, he's got. But the last name, I mean, he's called me Oyewole, Oyewole. I mean, I've been, and I'm so used to it, so I'm
You just, don't even correct people anymore.
I don't even correct them. I just let it go.
Yeah.
But yes, you said my name perfectly.
Excellent. Well, thank you. I wanted to start by talking a little bit about The Last Poets.
Mm-hmm.
What you guys did, you know, the style of what you did, reciting poetry over drum beats, set a pretty obvious template for rap, but where did that come from? Like, what influenced you?
Well, the thing about it is David Nelson, who was one of the original members, along with myself and Guylin Kane, David had, he was the one, I always give David Nelson the credit for being the father of the poets, in a sense, because he was older than I was, and he was the person that I actually worked for, and when they had anti-poverty programs back in the day. So he had an anti-poverty program called Double Block Recreational and Educational Program, 119th Street and 118th Street between 3rd and Lexington. And I was hired as his assistant recreation director. And all I did was just go get the basketballs and play basketball with the kids, or the volleyballs and play volleyball with them, or the jump rope for the girls. I didn't have very much to do. And I was dipping and dabbing into poetry at that time. And I was even trying to write a little poetry in French. And he was writing some poetry in Spanish. And we both realized we both liked poetry. We would share some ideas with each other. And then one day he said to me, while we were just hanging out, he says, you know, I would like to do a collective of poets to give an idea to black people that we can have guys from different walks of life coming together to deal with the same theme. Maybe that would let people know how much we need to unify, you know? And I said, I love that idea. And you see, the thing to me, I just wanted to be involved in the Black Power movement, worse than bad. When the movement came on, the Civil Rights movement never really enchanted me, because I'm not a turn-the-cheek guy. I believe in fighting back. If someone says, you can't eat in my restaurant, I give me some sticks and some hammer and nail. I built my own goddamn restaurant. You know, that's my headset.
Sure.
So Malcolm was really speaking to my heart, because he was all about self-determination and forget this trying to hang out and be integrated. I'm not interested. And Black Power was something, now looking back over my life, my mother and father lived Black Power. They never said it. They never gave me a doctrine to read.
Yeah, I mean, the name didn't exist.
No, and the word, the term never existed.
Yeah.
But they just lived it. My father brought Savannah, Georgia to New York City. He brought it to Queens. We raised collard greens and corn. And I used to feed rabbits and chickens before I went to school, right out there in Jamaica, Queens. And we had corn and tomatoes as big as your head. And we had grapes, because we had a house that had a grapevine, and he went on and took a piece from that grapevine and made another grapevine, and I hated it because I was a grape picker. And we had at least 100 gallons of wine we had every year. Christmas time is when the wine would really be ready to drink, because all before that, because the grapes are made in August and it would take time for it to ferment, and by December, the policemen knew they were going to get a gallon of wine, the mailman knew they were going to get a gallon of wine. The insurance man knew he was going to get a gallon of wine, and people looked forward to their gallons of wine. And our basement was like a wine cellar, and so we lived a power life, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where, I mean, there are many days we didn't have to go to a vegetable market, just go out into the yard and pick the greens and eat them fresh. We had a peach tree. My mother was crazy with flowers. I mean, that was one area my father and I could not even deal with. That part of the property was the garden. So they lived a certain way that insinuated or indicated that they were free and they were strong and they were unafraid. So when Black Power came on the scene, I was ready for it. I was ready for it, and I wanted to do something. I wanted to get involved. So David said that when he made the statement, it was about maybe a year before The Last Poets actually got started, and I went away to Drake University, and while I was at Drake, a guy who was the director of the recreational program in that same program. His name was Michael Gorkin, and I have to give Michael a shout because Michael Gorkin probably was the one who turned me on to my really my real true beginnings. Because I was at Drake in Des Moines. He was at the University of Iowa at Iowa City. Mm-hmm. Me and a young man named Abdul. Abdul had just gotten a brand new car. I remember it was burgundy. Oh my God! It was some kind of a. It was a nice car. It was burgundy, and it had come from the government. And I said, "How did the government give you a car?" He says, "Oh, my father makes cans." And he was from Saudi Arabia. My father made cans. And I thought when he said cans, I was thinking of little cans.
Yeah.
Found out later that they were oil cans. His father was a big oil magnate, you know, and he made the cans for the oil to go in.
Yeah.
So he was getting a stipend from the American government. He was going to school for free. And they sent him this car. And he couldn't drive. And I could drive. So I was driving the car. So I said, well, let's go. So I'd always pick some places to go. So I called up Michael Gorkin because I knew he was in University of Iowa. I said, we're coming to your school, man. We're going to visit. And so we came there. And I said, we're in a place. He said, got a hotel? He says, nice. He says, well, I'm going to go stay at my girl's house. I'll give you my apartment. You know, if you guys are lucky, you know, you have some fun in my place. And I'll never forget when we got to his apartment, on the table in the kitchen was the autobiography of Malcolm X. And he had a note that said, you should read this. I think you'll really appreciate it. And that opened up the whole world. Because Malcolm, I mean, he just represented so much. Like to use a quote from Ossie Davis, he was truly our black shining prince.
Right.
I mean, and I remember having seen him when I was a child. Maybe,
yeah, you said you remember seeing him in the streets of Harlem.
Yeah, on the streets of Harlem. And my aunt told my mother, she says, because, I mean, I wasn't in the conversation because at that time children should be seen and not heard. So my mother told my aunt told my mother, she said, that man over there talking, they're going to kill that man. And then my mother said, why? Because he's telling the truth. But they're going to kill him. And I could not understand. I wanted to get into that conversation real bad because I'm going to get my butt whipped if I don't tell the truth. This man's telling the truth and they're going to kill him? This doesn't make sense to me. I mean, it just didn't measure up.
Sure.
So when he got killed in 65, I was still in high school. But my teacher, Miss Carpenter, a real sweet, only black woman I ever known to actually major in Russian and learn how to speak Russian and all that stuff. But she's my English teacher and my homeroom teacher. She said, today is Monday. A great man was killed yesterday. She says, so you can go home. You're dismissed.
Wow.
We had an unofficial holiday, my whole class. I mean, because she was so distraught. I didn't know how important Malcolm was. I was not aware. But that was my beginning. And then later on, 2-3 years later, when I got this book, and I read the article, I read that book that whole weekend. I read the book. I didn't do anything else but read the book. I read the book. I was fascinated. So now I'm really revved up. I'm really ready to do something. So then to set the stage properly, David put my name. We weren't called The Last Poets. I was Charles Davis. He was David Nelson. And then it was Guyland Kane. And he put our names on a list to perform at Mount Morris Park on May 19th, 1968, commemoration for Malcolm X.
For Malcolm, yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, because he lived across the street from Mount Morris Park. And so we went to his apartment to try to organize what we were going to do, the poems we were going to do. And I was scared to death before that because I knew this day was coming. So I had come to Harlem about a week or two before and walked around just to get the vibe of what was happening, because I really didn't know what to write. I didn't know if I could say something that would grab the attention of the people. I was really insecure about it.
You said before then you'd mostly written like love poems.
That's all. That's all. I hadn't written anything. I got crazy when they killed Dr. King. That's when I kind of started thinking politically, because the first poem I wrote was called The Wall Street Journal, and I talked about how they were going to make a lot of money on selling buttons and pins and posters and pictures of Dr. King. And that's all. And he was going to become like a commodity that you could buy in the store. But his what he did won't really matter much, you know. And then I felt totally offended, even though I didn't agree with him. You know, I like Dr. King, you know, but I wasn't going to march with him because, you know, if somebody put their hands on me, I'm going to hit him. I'm not going to just say, we shall overcome. No, I'm not going to do that. But I felt like it was a real insult to black folks to have this guy who was a proclaimed leader of the civil rights movement just shot down like that. But Malcolm was my man. Malcolm was the guy that I really felt the strength and power from. And reading his book, Alex Haley did a fabulous job of giving us Malcolm, of giving us his life. So when this moment was coming, I went to Harlem and I walked around. And at the time, it was during the same time that the Isley Brothers had out a piece called It's Your Thing, Do What You Want to Do. I can't tell you who to sock it to. Well, the line that I was hearing when I was walking around Harlem was, what's your thing, brother? And brother said, well, I'm a Black Panther, or I'm a Muslim. And so then I realized that, oh, thing is like a revolutionary pronoun. You know, it wasn't like, what's your thing? I work for DuPont, or I work for Dow Chemical, you know. And it's like, what is your thing in relationship to the movement, you know? And so I said, okay. So I took that, and I wrote a poem entitled, What Is Your Thing, Brother? Is it a black thing? Will it save black women and children? Will it build a black nation? What is your thing? So I used that hook line because, and I realized that particular formula is a formula that has been everlasting, because the poetry really comes from the people. And I snatched that expression from the people and gave it back to the people. And when I went on stage, when we went on stage that day to do that, I was nervous, but when I opened up my mouth and started doing it, everybody was on the same page. And Kane, his first poem was Niggas Are Untogether People. And then David's first poem was Are You Ready, Black People? And I thought, when we were at David's house, I said, well, we're going to go on as a group. We don't want to go on looking like just individuals. We want to go on as a group. So how can we confirm that? So I said, well, let's see if we can sing. David's voice is kind of weak. Kane can't hold a note if you handed it to him. So that was out.
Right.
So I said, well, even though they can't sing, maybe we can chant. I had seen on television, which really kind of blew my mind, Howard University students were having a demonstration to get rid of their president at the time. I remember his name. I remember the incident. His name was Nesbitt. They were trying to get rid of him and bring in a new president. They didn't like this guy. And they had an effigy of him hanging from a tree. And they were actually, marching around the tree saying, beep, beep, bang, bang, Ungawa, Black Power. And then they change up and they say, are you ready, niggas? You got to be ready. Are you ready, niggas? You got. And I said, whoa, I had never heard anything so fierce on and seeing it on TV. I don't know what channel it was. Maybe it was a news clip. But I remember it distinctly. So at this particular moment, I'm saying to myself, well, we can't sing together, we can chant together, because that doesn't require any voice. So I said, well, let's go on stage chanting, are you ready, nigga? And we practiced it. Are you ready, nigga? We got to be ready. Are you ready, niggas? You got to get ready. Are you ready? And so we went on stage chanting that. By the time we got to the center of the stage, everyone in the park was chanting, are you ready, niggas? You got to be ready. Are you? Oh, man, it was so special. And I felt very, very good about it because I had picked something that the people jumped on right away. And now there were drummers on stage. A brother named Hakeem, he had some African dancers and drummers. He's still with us. He's now a photojournalist for jazz groups. When you see around the city, he's always got his camera taking pictures. He plays the drums, I guess, maybe sometimes. But then he was strictly a drummer, and he had a dance group. They had just finished, and they were getting ready to leave the stage. And I told him to stay. I told him, just stay there. So the first time we performed, we had a percussion background because I had told the guy, just because I felt like
we just needed, in the moment.
In the moment. But he wasn't the percussionist that we used for any other gigs. It just so happened that he was there the first time.
Yeah.
But then the search came for us to look for some background, you know, musical background. We even tried a guitar player one time. I think his name was Lynn Chandler. I think it was his name. He was good. He had a couple pieces out. He was a good guy, nice guy. But his stuff was more folky, and it just didn't have the fire that we wanted.
Yeah.
So he wasn't working. We tried a bunch of other conga players. Couldn't get the right... We had to get the right person who could play the voice of the drum, not just beat the drum. And we got Elijah, and this brother, oh my God, he was perfect. Every single poem that you hear of the Last Poets, especially in our earlier pieces, every poem had a different rhythm.
Yeah.
Because he gave it its own voice, its own personality. And plus, he knew the drum. He knew how to play the conga drum. And so he was, matter of fact, Elijah was so important in the group. And so if you came to the group with a poem and it, you know, you had to just share it with the rest of the guys before it could be in the program. If you got on stage and started doing your poem and Elijah did not open up that duffel bag and start playing on them drums,
you wouldn't perform again.
Your poem was dead in the water.
Yeah.
And I thought I had written one of the greatest poems I've never done called Get Hip. Because it was a poem just coming down on that whole bourgeoisie middle class out in Queens that I was raised into. And I was ranting and raving. I said, get hip, you lame, sick, colorful. It was just a bunch of ranting and raving. There was no poetry. It was just me venting. It was really nothing else. And I got on stage and I did this with vigor and ready for Elijah to play something behind me. And he sat right there. His drum sat right there. He never even looked at the daggone duffel bag. It broke my heart. And he was my friend, too. I mean, besides the fact he was our percussionist, we used to hang out. And then after I finished, Kane said, we never read that crap on stage, man. This Last Poet's got much more integrity than that. That's not a damn poem. That's some old ranting and raving about the people that you are, that you came from. He says, forget that. You know, I want to punch him. Because, you know, I had not only written a poem, but I typed it up on my grandfather's typewriter. I typed it up. That's how sure I was. Because it was really just getting stuff out of me.
Yeah.
But it did not have the poetic stuff.
Yeah.
And the one thing I did learn at that moment, that black folks have an aesthetic, and that the Last Poets were pumping that aesthetic. And I was a part of it. And Kane, even though we had problems together during the time we were in the group, and even till this day, he blames me for a lot of stuff that's totally outrageous, but he gave us our aesthetic.
Yeah.
He was a genius. There's no question. And he gave us the aesthetic. He gave us the stuff that made us write poetry and not garbage. And I appreciate him. He says, you know, you can make anything poetic. Niggas can be poetic. Anything can be poetic. He says, but you have to employ poetry. You just can't just run off the mouth and not be a poet about it. And so I clearly began to understand the difference between poetry and the rest of the language. And the thing about it, because I'm pretty smart, I started getting good real fast. Mm-hmm. I mean, to the point where I have a poem entitled New York, New York.
I wanted to ask you about that.
The Big
yeah.
Apple.
Yeah.
And Kane had a poem entitled New York, and his poem was tough. I loved his poem. He said, New York, where the movement moves like Elmer's glue. You know, like it ain't moving too much. You know, moving too fast. And I thought that was a hot line. But I went on again and snatched something from the people. Because the people would say, New York, New York, the Big Apple. You know, that was what I hear slick folks say, man. Man, what you tell me? I just moved to the Big Apple, man. You know, New York is Big Apple, you know. And we'll always hear about that. I never even realized that the reason why this was called the Big Apple. I didn't even know they had apple orchards in New York. You know,
right.
It was just a nickname.
Is that the one that you never let your mother hear? Because of all the cursing?
Yeah. I never let her hear that album. No, my sisters, I think they probably played it for, but I wouldn't, because listen, I still respect my mother. I would never curse for my mother. You know, damn turns into darn. You know, shit turns into shucks right away.
Yeah.
You know, but the fact is that poem became a big piece in the group, because we'd be on stage and somebody might yell out, "Do New York, do New York." And Kane would get ready to do his poem because it was older and it was a poem we had in the program for a while. And then he'd go to the mic and somebody said, "No, man, not that one, the other one." And I know it was killing him. It was killing him. It was like stabbing him in his heart.
Yeah.
But I was getting stronger. I was getting better as a poet. And our relationship was getting less and less tolerable.
Mm-hmm.
And but But it was, you know, through everything good comes, there's going to be conflict to have something really good come through. Yes. And so we had our conflict. I love the brother dearly. I just wish he loved himself as much.
Sure. You absolutely. Yeah, it was funny. In Slick Slaves, it seemed like the relationship between the two main characters seem to kind of reflect a little bit the last poets. These guys are headstrong and they fight, but in the end they kind of have a grudging respect for each other.
Yeah, that I think that carries over. You know, I don't think any playwright or novelist or writer period can get out of yourself. You know, you have to come from yourself in the writing. So a lot of stuff that's going to be written by any writer is going to have some tales, some signs, some pieces of his flesh in it.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things that, you know, speaking of New York, you know, on that first album, New York is like basically almost a character.
Mm-hmm.
And not always, including in New York, the Big Apple, not always a positive one. What, at the time you were doing the poems that would be on that record, you know, what was the city like for you? How did the city seep into your writing and become like such a big character?
Well, New York City was repressive. I mean, it was oppressive and repressive in many ways. A lot of things that we wanted to see happen here that weren't happening here. It was a time when I think, you know, we'd had the anti-poverty programs that came around to give a little relief for some of the burdens that were taking place. But we're looking at this as this big metropolis as the monster of all metropolises, and how badly being treated black folks were. I mean, kids were being shot, just like Trayvon Martin was shot recently. We had Clifford Glover back then. We had our issues with the police. The city had some, and then the Black Panthers were being harassed, and I mean, Malcolm got killed. There's so many different things happening in the city that we just didn't find too comforting and too appreciative. I guess I've always had like a love-hate thing for the city. Since I've gotten older, I mean, it's more of a love and more of a greater love, because I've been so many places, and this city is without question a truly great city. First of all, the transportation system has got to be one of the best on the planet. I mean, in terms of getting around the city, there's a train or a bus that can get you closer to your destination. There's no doubt about it. So there are certain aspects of the city that I admit are fantastic. But there was a political kind of a aura that just seemed to be a foot on the necks of a lot of black folks here. And a lot of things couldn't take place. And Harlem was demonized in many ways, as well as parts of Brooklyn. And all of that was still, it's not as much now, but it was then, it was seemingly a lot more obvious. Mm-hmm. And so that was my take on New York. It wasn't the place that I was going to praise or celebrate. It was really the source of a lot of, it was a target for, it was like what I said. It's a state of mind that doesn't mind fucking up a brother, you know, and you have those kinds of folks that, I mean, New York is that kind of place where they'll just chew you up and spit you out. And this has a certain kind of callousness to it that, you know, still exists. I mean, when you consider the fact that this town, 2012, we have a mayor who has a bank account of $27 billion. That's unspeakable money. That's stupid money. And then you can get on TV and tell us that the MTA needs more money, and we're going to have to raise the prices on the bridges and the tolls, and we're going to have to lay off firemen. We've got to lay off teachers. And I mean, do you really want to be the mayor? Or you just want to, like, fart on the people? What are you doing? I mean, you got $27 billion. You can give the money to Tiny Tim if it's a conflict of interest to you, and have him take your shoebox full of money. You can give up $1 billion, and you wouldn't even miss it.
Yeah.
And the city would be straight. A lot of people wouldn't like lose their jobs. I mean, I cannot understand for the life of me how come they got people occupying Wall Street. I don't understand how come people are not occupying his bank account, occupying his house, occupying his car, everything else. This man has got too much money for any human being in any one lifetime. to be, he changed the rules because he liked being mayor so much. So he spent some money. I'm sure he spent some money to get the rules changed. Yeah. But, man, share some of that wealth, guy. I mean, he's making crazy money. So the city hasn't changed very much. It's still a capitalistic king. It's a pig in many ways. And but there are some wonderful, wonderful people here that I've met over the years, and some have gone on. But it's a charming city in a very uncharming situation.
We'll be right back with part two of our conversation with Abiodun Oyewole. You're listening to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. Welcome back to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. Here's part two of our talk with a true legend, the poet Abiodun Oyewole. We continued our chat by asking him what it means to be a revolutionary poet. This led, as you'll hear, to an amazing discussion of his time living down south and some serious trouble that he got into while there.
Speaking of the city, there was a period of time when you didn't live here and you moved down south.
Right.
And right before then, I was reading something you wrote where you said you'd been frustrated about being a poet. Mm-hmm. You said, "I began to feel that being a poet was a pitiful example of being a revolutionary."
Yeah.
Have you ever changed your mind about that feeling? Like, is it possible to be a revolutionary poet?
Well, I really kind of thought I was cheating being a poet. Mm-hmm. Because I wasn't getting my hands dirty. I didn't carry a gun. I wasn't ready to fight the police. I felt that there was a militancy that I needed to deal with on some level. Because I could sit and look at a situation and write a poem and get a lot of applause and people would call me revolutionary or not. But I just didn't feel like I was doing it. I guess because I had such an abundance of energy and I just wanted to see things more physically move than what was happening. So the poetry became not as important because I wanted to do something to change things physically. What happened is, what really opened up for me was going down to North Carolina and being a part of the, I guess you could say, the cultural revolution, in a sense, because I went down with Kabiesi, the brother who actually gave me my name, and I didn't go with him. I went. It was actually a program sponsored by the United Church of Christ called. It was supposed to be the Transitional Year Academy. It was supposed to be an academy that we were establishing at Brooks, North Carolina, which is the home of the very first Black junior college in the country. Brooks is a little town, not even a town. It's a little section in between Enfield and Whittaker. Those are two smaller towns in North Carolina. And in Brooks, that place was used as a resort for many of the preachers from United Church of Christ. And they had beautiful land, beautiful buildings, everything. So it was decided, Charles Cobb was in charge of the United Church of Christ at the time, of the Committee for Racial Justice aspect mm-hmm. of the United Church of Christ. So they decided to use that as a place for this transitional year academy, an academy that would take kids who were ready to go to college, but they really weren't ready, and give them some culture, give them some remediation, and prepare them so that when they went to college, they could matriculate and not take remediation courses. So it was a great idea, and there were quite a number of young people who were scheduled to be involved with this thing. But the problem is this, and now Kabiesi, who was also known as Baba Osurgiman Adefumi, he had the force. He wanted to get down south because he wanted to start construction of an African village. And I knew this, and so that was something that was in the back of my mind. I had become Yoruba, and my wife had got into the religion. My fat Kabiesi even taught her how to make dashikis and other things. And so we had I met what three of his five wives and saw that whole lifestyle of how, you know, things were done. And then he gave me the language. We used to walk and talk, and he'd say, "Obi Reen is woman," and he just told me certain things, gave me some language in the Yoruba, of the Yoruba people, and told me that the majority, the vast majority of the folks that came from West Africa were Yorubas, were taken from Benin and parts of Nigeria, and says, and it was a case of not the white man coming over there and snatching us up, but other blacks there selling us into slavery.
Sure.
And he says something that people didn't know. So I got a great, great, great history lesson from him. And he says, and I really want to get down south because I have visions of building an African town, an African village down here. He says, I get better readings down here and all that kind of stuff. So he had read the situation because in the religion, you have the process they call ifa divination, where you can throw the shells and you can read what's happening. You can read what's going on. You can read what's going to happen. So he read the situation and he said, the transition from your academy is never going to happen. He says, but I'm going to make these people pay for us, you know, being uprooted.
Yeah.
He says, we're going to get more money than what they had planned to give us.
Mm.
So that, I think they had planned to give us something like $2,000 a piece for uprooting us from New York and, you know, sorry, sitting on work, so see you later. And I think he got something like $4,000 a piece for us. So because he did, I gave him $1,000 because that was like extra money I wasn't even expecting. And that went towards the investment in the first piece of land we had in Sheldon, South Carolina. The name of the village is Oyotunji. It still is in existence. He died, unfortunately, some years ago. And his son, I understand, is keeping it, trying to refurbish it and so forth. But that became the work involved that I was looking for because I was really about that. So when he went down to Sheldon, South Carolina, after the Transitory Academy thing didn't work, I went to Shaw University in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I started going to school as well as working as a college developer. And I had started a Yoruba society. I had students wearing African clothing, changing their names, having Yoruba marriages, all kinds of stuff. I would blow away the kids when they come out and do their little step shows using the Greek fraternities and sororities. I would bring my African drummers and dancers out and say, we ain't no damn Greeks, we're African people. And I'd play the drums and wipe them out. Some people really just thought I was a nightmare on that campus because I was killing whatever they thought they were in love with.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was very, very obvious. We actually did a whole bunch of collages and beautified the campus. I mean, it was crazy. I had a nice amount, but what happened? One thing led to another. And I used to have town meetings every Thursday because I wanted the students and everybody else to know what we were doing, why we were Africanizing ourselves and what the Yoruba culture was all about. And it was a chance to really just rehash this whole cultural movement. And then one guy in particular spoke up and said, yeah, man, I see all of your beautiful African clothes and your grand African names. So what you going to do when the man vamps on you, you know? He says, you ain't got no guns, you can't protect yourself. And I said, any punk can get a gun. So when I said that, I set myself up. I let my ego get the best of me. And I designed a plan for us to rob some guns from Thorns and Dixies. And I made sure I was not there because I knew people thought I was crazy to do that. But I set the plan up. My boys did it. We brought the guns. We were actually stashing the guns in the basement of the president's mansion. And that's where we did the school newspaper. So we had access to that. And the two big mouth guys that had challenged me originally, they dropped their duffel bag with the guns in it because they heard a sound and they thought that, you know, they were going to get caught with guns or whatever. They came back empty handed and they were laughed at. I was home and I sent the message, said, don't tell them not to go back. Don't worry about it. Forget about it. They went back. And they went back with a guy who was a spy in my organization, who we named after that Sirhan Sirhan.
Yeah.
This guy that killed Robert Kennedy.
Kennedy, yeah.
And they got arrested, and I felt totally responsible. I came on the campus the next morning, and Coach Clements of the football team, he says, three of your boys in jail. And I heard it was four that had gone back. So I'm trying to figure out how one got out on his own. Then we found out that one person was a spy. So one guy, Olubayo, I called his mother. I felt so silly calling his mother to tell her to get her son out of jail, you know, for this revolutionary activity that we've done. And the other two guys, I didn't have any way of getting in touch with their parents. And I couldn't get a bail bondsman. The bail bondsman was Cofield. He was the guy, if anybody got in trouble at the campus, he was always there to bail you out. He wasn't touching Bub or Marshall because he knew that they were going to run. They weren't exactly savory characters.
Yeah.
But I felt responsible because they were in my group. And I knew, and I heard from a white kid about maybe some months before that, where the Klan had their meetings, where they had their regular meetings. And this white boy, actually what happened, I saw the Klan marching down Fayetteville Street in Raleigh, and I was blown away. Because the only time I'd ever seen pictures of Klan members with hoods on was on TV, you know. But I'm looking at these guys live, you know, and with the hoods marching like it's okay. I was amazed. And I was standing out there with my folks, and a rock came from over from behind me and hit a Klansman upside his head, and he was bleeding. They stopped, they attended to him, and I looked back, and it was this white group, and they were yelling and carrying on, and there was this white kid, I don't even remember his name. He said, and I went over to him, I said, wow, I said, that's kind of bold, man. I said, we might have a riot here, you know. He says, man, I hate those people. I was working for them last summer. He says, they tried to recruit me. I was raised in Brooklyn, man. I like black people, you know. I said, man, I dig. He says, I know where they have their headquarters, man. We ought to torch the place. We ought to burn that shit down. And I thought about it for one brief moment, but then I said, nah, I had never done anything like that. And I wasn't, he was so gung-ho about it, but he gave me the address. He told me where it was, you know, on East 64, gave me the directions. So now I'm in a situation where I can't get my guys out of jail, and I figured maybe if I rob this place, the Klan's place, they'll have money. I can kill two birds with one stone, embarrass the Klan, and get my boys out of jail. Well, that's basically what happened, but in the process, I got caught, and I was seen, and it was a big manhunt. It was a big mess, a big, big, big mess. And I did it on the lady I was married to at the time. It happened to be her birthday, January 22nd, and she even told me, she says, I don't think today is a good day. I said, who's doing this, me or you? I got really arrogant and indignant and did it, and I got, you know, of course, make a long story short, I got 12 to 20 years, me and my partner, Alexander Young, 12 to 20 years in the state penitentiary of North Carolina. I got out in 3 years. Yeah. I did, to be honest, I needed that time. It was the best time of my life because it just calmed me down. It made me think. It made me recognize who I really was and what I really had to offer. I wrote like a maniac. I wrote two books. Neither one has been published. One is entitled Jesse, and it's really about a young revolutionary guy. Just almost it's autobiographical, and his fight between the militancy and the cultural piece. And then another book is called Lucius and the Spirits, and I love that. That's my science fiction classic. It's great. Lucius dies, and he's trying to get his life back by going to the Valley of the Dead. I mean, it's amazing. It's a fabulous story. When I weaved Yoruba tales and just my own imagination. And it was just wonderful. It was great because I had time to do that, you know. I wrote a bunch of poems. I wrote a bunch of songs, short stories, essays. I mean, I just wrote. I remember one time the correction officer said to me, he says, what you writing about? You always writing something. I said, I could be writing about you, man. He says, if I don't give you no damn pen and no pad, you ain't gonna write nothing. I said, I would bite my finger and you come in here and this whole place would be surrounded with poetry. I would write in blood. And he said, New York, they call me New York. I said, you crazy, New York, you do that too. I mean, but I was serious about writing, and which caused me to develop a friend named Jonathan Bird, who had been in third time on the same bid for manslaughter. Some white man had touched his wife's ass in the pharmacy, and he saw it, and he came and he hit the guy, knocked the guy down, and got his head knocked and died. So they gave him 10 years for manslaughter. The only reason he got 10 and not life is because people in the store spoke up for him and said it was a violation. And he was coming to his wife's assistance or whatever. But they gave him 10 years anyway. And he had told me, he said that he had been in there two other times and he had wanted to write this book about hustling because after the first time he got put in prison, he had lost his teaching license in Mecklenburg School County, and he became a hustler.
I'm saying he
couldn't get a job. Yeah. But Bird was smart, and Bird became a very, very good hustler. So all the games, like the note, the pig, the jug, all those games, the insurance game, all those games, he taught me as well. I mean, I was writing my book during the day, and in the evening time, we would get together and read to each other. We were like the TV show for each other. You know, I'd read to him what I wrote during the day. He'd read to me what he wrote during the day. So we're proofreading our work as well and sharing it and keeping it and following the story. I mean, it was like exciting to the point where, like, I was, it's something that if that could be done in the world, I mean, we could get a lot of things accomplished. But, you know, we had time, so we used it. But it was during that time when I had a chance to really reflect and think and put the pieces together. And I think because of the way I was moving, how fast I was going, I needed that time just to slow down and to get myself to really get myself together. So as far as I'm concerned, my stay in prison was essential and necessary to where I'm at today, you know?
Oh. We talked a little bit off camera about, you know, artists who have sampled The Last Poet's work, and in particular about the Biggie song, mm-hmm. right? About Party and Bullshit that uses a Last Poet's tune. So your first album, obviously with The Last Poet's, often sampled, often interpolated.
Yeah.
And I was just curious about your feelings. I know we talked about it a little bit, but, you know, maybe for the, mm-hmm. for the camera's time, a little bit about Party and Bullshit, because obviously when you used it, it was, you know, hectoring
right.
and mocking, and in Biggie's version, it's celebratory.
Yes. Well, you know, unfortunately, I've also stated along the line, in the absence of a movement, the circus is in town. And this is what we're dealing with, a circus. And in the circus, you know, you got clowns. You got people who are standing out for just to make people laugh or just to get attention. And that's what's been happening. Because there is no movement. The movement kind of put people who weren't even in the movement in order.
Right. You started, you had the Black Arts Movement kind of in full swing.
Yeah. And so, but there's nothing now like it was then.
Yeah.
So consequently, you know, folks can get away with saying Party and Bullshit at a chant and not see the significance of it as it was meant to be. It bothers me when I see that, but it also gives me more fuel to recognize that I've got a lot of work to do. And so I do have a nice amount of youth who I have the ears of all across the country, and I'm real grateful for the relationships I've established with some of our younger rappers and young sisters as well. And it just keeps me working. It keeps me recognizing that we have not reached the place that we need to be at as a people, and that we still need to re-inspire and re-motivate, because things easily get twisted in America because of the financial piece, and whatever seems to be attractive can be prostituted.
Yeah, definitely. So maybe I was wondering if you can talk about that a little more, the idea that when you were around the Black Power movement, the Black Arts movement kind of kept you in line. And other
artists in line. Absolutely. The Black Arts movement kept me in line because where there were certain tenets that you live by, and there's certain things that you cherish, you held in high esteem. I mean, it's almost like, you know, back in the days, I mean, we've always held our mothers, we've always revered our mothers. You could talk about a black guy's mother, or a black girl's mother, you could get into a fight very easily because mother was the center of our lives. And you may say something about somebody's father, it may not be a fight, it may not even be a discussion. But when you talk about somebody's mother, I mean, our national curse word is motherfucker, you know? So we mothers are very, very important. So it's just like everything else. There is an order and there's a sensibility that needs to be adhered to. And that, as far as I'm concerned, the movement gave us that. The movement helped us really see how we should be towards one another and what we should build and how we should direct the path that we wanted, the way we wanted to go. And I think it was a very powerful movement. A lot of fantastic work came out of the Black Arts Movement, and not to mention the people, from Amiri Baraka to...
And who you knew and were close to.
Very much so. I actually wrote one of the famous poems on the album with Amiri Baraka right there. It was Gash Man.
Right, which you said was about him, right?
Yeah, it was, basically, because we were having a conversation. I used to go over to Newark, New Jersey to try to get as much information from him as possible because I was a kid. I was 19. I didn't know anything, and I wanted to learn as much as I could, as quickly as I could. So every chance I got, I would be around someone who I thought could give me some information. And I liked Amiri. Amiri was cool. He's always cool. He's always like bebop cool. And we were sitting in the car talking, and he was saying something to me that was important. Everything he said I felt was important. But I noticed that his eyes left me, and I followed his eyes, and his eyes were following this ass that was walking down Broad Street. And I said to him, I felt insulted at the time because he was supposed to be talking to me. I said, man, you ain't no revolutionary man. You're a Gash Man, like that. And I don't know where the word came from. I don't know how it came, but it just came. And he said to me at that time, he says, if you don't use that, man, I'm going to use that. That's great. And I wrote a piece called Gash Man. Yeah. And it's quite, I mean, so if some ears that hear it right away, they got it. They know. And some people don't know, you know, but it's, if you know, you know. If you don't, you don't. That's all I can say.
Yeah. So a big, important figure in Black history for you has always been Joe Louis. You wrote at least two poems about him, maybe more. Joe Louis, the boxer.
Oh yeah, Joe the Brown Bomber.
Right, but it surprised me because most of the big moments in his career, including the Schmeling fight, happened before you were born.
Yes.
What do you remember your parents and other people saying about Louis and about the Schmeling fight in particular?
I just remember seeing the stuff seeing footage of him knocking Max Schmeling out in Yankee Stadium, and the picture that I love of Joe that I remember so much is him walking down 125th Street with two women on his arms, on each arm. And he was as handsome a man as Muhammad Ali was back in the day. Mm-hmm. He didn't have the glibness. He didn't have the articulation that Ali had. Ali was something to behold. I really feel so bad that the youth of today have no idea of just how fantabulous Ali was. He was quick-witted, quick-minded, quick-talking, and just a beautiful-looking man.
How much he scared people is the other thing people forget.
Yeah, yes. I mean, it was really amazing. But Joe represented Harlem to me. And Harlem was always a place that I just fell in love with. Because we go there, I went to Harlem every Sunday for church. I was with my folks at church. We went to Southern Baptist Church in Harlem. And so I'd see Harlem, and I'd see folks dressed up in their cashmere, long-length cashmere coats and their fedora hats. And I just thought, I didn't know that those folks didn't own Harlem. I thought they owned everything. They just looked so, it was just arrogantly black, you know. Yeah. And I just fell in love with it. And Joe Louis represented that to me. He was like that character that made, you know, the Brown Bomber, that made Harlem like I said in the piece, he is the fist and the kiss of the Harlem we miss, you know. And that still stands. I mean, he was very, I really had a certain feeling for him, I think. Even though I love Ali tremendously, Joe just seemed to be the foundation.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I wanted to, you know, talk about when you first started, you talked about the Holy Terror album. And you worked on that with a guy I've met a few times and know a little bit. And have a tremendous amount of respect for, and who is an overlooked figure in early hip-hop, Bill Laswell.
Oh, man. Bill Laswell is the governor of the wild seeds. That's the name I gave him. Because he takes on people that nobody else will deal with. Either they're too rough, ridiculous, they get high too much, or something.
I mean, Sly and Robbie, you work with.
You know, I mean, you go down to in the studio, you can see James Blood Armour in there recording, or who's the brother? Down by the river, I shot my baby.
That's Neil Young?
Who?
Neil Young?
No, it's a black guy.
Oh, okay.
I can't think of his name right now, but he's classic. You know, if I say his name, it'll come to me. Yeah. But great artists. I mean, he had on Holy Terror. We got Bootsy Collins and George Clinton. I mean, those guys are outside the box, and some other folks. Buddy Miles. He and Buddy Miles. See, people heard him sing, and I think some people might know he plays instruments. But Buddy Miles plays everything.
Not just the drums.
No, not just the drums. He can play piano. He can play anything, and he sings like a bird. I mean, he's off the chain.
Yeah.
He was singing some song. Don't ever leave me lonely. Tell me you love me only now and forever. Let it be me. Mm-hmm. He was singing that song. And it was fabulous. And it was a rehearsal. I don't know if he recorded it or not, but Buddy Miles is something else. He was something. And he had a very, very, very big appetite. We'd order our food from this it's not Chinese. It's the other. What's the other?
Thai. Yeah.
From a Thai restaurant.
Yeah.
And I always order the same thing: chicken and basil sauce. I love it. Love it. Love it. Well, Buddy ordered two, and they were both for him. I mean, and he could do two dinners after he had coked up a gram of coke. Which I don't even know how that's humanly possible,
right?
Because I've dealt with coke, and coke freezes up everything, and you don't really want to eat. You just want to try to keep your mouth open or closed or something. You know, I mean, it's like, whoa, this guy could do that like it was nothing, like that was just an appetizer, and then he'd knock it, he'd kill it, he'd hook it up with some food. He was amazing.
And Bill somehow got an album out of everyone.
I mean, he was a performer. He's a great, great artist. But Bill Laswell has to be one of the coolest people I've ever met in my life, and one of the most sincere artists, because he's also an artist. He plays bass. A lot of people don't even realize that. And he's very good. But I love his demeanor and how he handles situations. And he will do what he can to look out for you. He's a real, genuine human being. And he cared for those folks that a lot of the people in the industry, you know, like maybe someone giving this guy trouble at this particular record company, whatever. If Bill felt you had the talent and you could produce something good, he would bring you put you in his camp. And he had, I think, some of the best talent around, probably still does, because he's still doing stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm just happy that we're friends in this lifetime.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely. So the other day, I came across one of your plays from 1977, from Comments, which was obviously a response to Inosaki Shange's For Color Girls. So looking back at her play and at your response and at that general climate of the relationship between like the Black Power movement or what the Black Power movement had changed into and the feminist movement and all that kind of stuff, how do you feel about your play now? Do you feel like maybe there was something in For Colored Girls that you didn't, you know, fully grasp at the time, or do you sort of stand behind what you said then?
Say exactly what I felt then, I say now, because even, you know, Colored Girls was put out again on a film.
Yeah.
And Tyler Perry, I think, has something to do with it, and he really has something to do with it, because he put some of his boys in there because he's gay, and he put a gay person in there. And Itazaki did not have any gay person in the original script on stage. Mm-hmm. It was void of any kind of gay practice. But I think Janet Jackson's character in the movie was looking at guys when he was looking at her, which, you know, I just felt totally offended. I said that was unnecessary to do that. You know, I'm not campaigning against the gays, but the pumping up the volume of the gay thing has gotten out of hand. It's almost like, again, when the absence of a movement, you'll have everything else will crop up. Everything else becomes very important, and then you have to be politically correct about things you say, all that kind of stuff. The bottom line is that Colored Girls was a direct response of Colored Girls was a direct response to the fact that we had two camps forming. You had the women's camp and then the men's camp, and we were having meetings. The relationship between black men and black women was teetering, was on the edge. I mean, I couldn't understand this because my whole thing is that I have always I like women. And I've always gone with old women, primarily because that's where I got my wisdom from. I mean, I've always had female friends who would share knowledge with me, and give me stuff that I could use besides sex. And it was, and I couldn't understand how come we were having these bitter discussions, fighting against each other. I mean, there were a bunch of little forums and stuff. And Colored Girls was fostering that because it was even pushed most as a female play. Like, when I went to see it, I think it was 90% of the people in the audience were women. There weren't any men in the audience. And I simply, the first time I saw it, I didn't even feel offended. I said, well, I'm not any of those characters. You know, this is her take on things. But Chuck Davis, he's a dance teacher. He has a dance company here in the city. Very dear friend of mine. He asked me, he says, what are you doing since you've been back in New York City? I just come back home from the joint. And I said, well, I'm teaching. I got a brand new son, you know, I'm married, you know. He said, I didn't ask you all that. I'm saying, what are you doing, Abby O'Doon? What are you doing? I said, man, I'm doing enough. I'm taking care of my life. He says, you got to do more than that. He says, you're expected to do more than what you're doing. You need to write a response to that girl's play. She's cutting off your little pricks. And I said, man, that she can do whatever she wants to do. I'm not interested in that. And so what my lawyer at the time, Larry Phillips, he gave me tickets. He says, listen, I got tickets here for you to see this play. Take your wife, go see it, and then go backstage and talk to Itazaki Shangi. She's the person that wrote it. And tell her if she wants to record her play, that we have the apparatus, the means to do that, because it's getting a lot of play and it's basically poetry. So I said, okay, fine. So when I saw it, so now I know what the discussions are all about. I saw the play firsthand. And when Bo threw the babies out the window, I didn't identify with Bo, but the truth be known, the play does not celebrate black men. It celebrates women, and it even ends by saying where the women come together and they form a circle and they rub each other's backs and they say, I found God in myself and I love her fiercely. So they've just extracted the man completely off the page. And all the men, only man in the play that's worth even talking about, I guess, that could be saved is somebody that said she was in love with Toussaint Louverture when she was 9 years old. That's like a mythology. And she loved Willie Colon's music. Fine. But all the male characters were just a waste and a problem. I wrote a big article. It was published in Amsterdam News. And it didn't work because this girl had a play. People were taking busloads of people coming from Alabama, Mississippi, everywhere to the Booth Theater to see this play. So I said, okay, I will do this. And I did the response because of one thing. Years ago, William Styron had done a book entitled William Styron's Confessions of Nat Turner. And it was such an abomination until 10 black writers got together, Lerone Bennett, John Henry Clark, and I don't know all the other cats, but I know that they were involved. And they blasted that. They came down hard on William Styron's version of Nat Turner, because he was one of the only guys in history that truly fought back in a way that we all can understand. He fought fire with fire, and had a white guy to work with him who was clear. John Brown was no joke. And so I said, well, a response has been done to a literary piece before. Mm-hmm. I said, so I won't be the first one to actually write a response. So when there's something, and then the other thing too, Aku Kadago, who was one of the early younger members in the cast, she lived upstairs in my building, and that was funny. And her, she and my wife were very good friends. And when she came downstairs and told us that she was in this play, she said it's kind of lopsided. It could use a response because Akua is she loves men. She loves her daddy. She loves her boyfriend. She just likes men. She didn't want to really come off as a woman that was slashing men. And so, so when I saw the play, I told her, I said, I'm gonna write a response. She said, I think it deserves a response. And so that was another endorsement. So I went on and did it. And then, of course, people saying, well, you could do it because you're a poet. She's a poet. Her poetry is real strong. And you could relate to that. So then I started just having these personal little conversations, like with my lady, for example, when I said, looking at some of her work, because I was studying the script, and she says, give me my stuff. I want my stuff back. Give me my leg back with the mosquito bite and all that. You know, give me my stuff back. And so then my lady, she just, after I read the poem, she says, nobody can take your stuff. She says, you can give it away. But somebody could actually rape me. All they would be doing is violating me. But I'm not giving them shit. And I said, wow, can't nobody take your stuff? So I wrote a piece called Can't Nobody Take Your Stuff.
Yeah.
And it's hot. And it was bad. It was dazzling because it really says that, you know, you have to participate in that decadence in order for it to really be as bad as, you know, you're making it. You have to be a participant. And so I took up, and then she had a section called No More Love Poems, I think part 1, 2, 3, and 4. And I had a big suite called Why We Should Love. She had a piece talking about, I'm tired of hearing brothers say, I'm sorry, baby. And I wrote a piece called, I ain't never said I was sorry. Sorry for what? You know, so I mean, I really just, punch for punch, back and forth, and it actually made for fantastic drama. Enzazaki, unfortunately, looked at it as a declaration of war, and she thought that I was at war with her. And I had to even tell her personally. I said, "You know what, Enzazaki, I could never have written comments if you had written a piece of shit." I said,
"Right, it sounds even now like you have a like the words had an effect on you. You still remember
yes.
them." 35
absolutely. I mean, I said, "Do you actually wrote something that had merit, you know?" And it just felt like it missed out on certain aspects that we need to be concerned with. And so I'm bringing into the mix that in order for us to fix our problem, it's going to take men and women working together. It ain't going to be the woman get off in the corner and do their own thing. Men get to do. No, we got to come together. And the thing that was really interesting, when I was at Shaw University, I had a young sister that went to school with me named Doris Kemp. Quiet. The rebirth of Gwendolyn Brooks, but would never, ever, ever take that mantle, would never, ever want that kind of publicity. Wrote the greatest poetry I've ever heard before since, other than Gwendolyn. When I first met her, I used to have a radio station when I was in prison and at Shaw. I spent all my time, most of my time, in the radio station, WSHA. Mm-hmm. I did two radio shows, one called Variations Phase 1, because I didn't have a title for either one, and the other one was called Variations Phase 2. And I had some fun on those stations because I was doing stuff that I knew was going to be heard by the prisoners, because I was out on study release, and I would do my show during the day, then I'd be back in prison. By the time my shows came on, my shows ran from 9 to 10 and then from 10 to 11. And the brothers would say, I'm listening to you, New York, man, I got you on my headphones, you know. And I would read to them 15-minute segments of Native Son on my first show, And in the second show, I'd read 15-minute segments of The Spook Who Sat By the Door, because those books were not even allowed in the prison. So, and my promo was, and the next time somebody asked you if you read a book lately, you said yes. You say yes, even though somebody's reading to you, you know. And oh, they liked that idea, and folks were getting, it was a real big deal. I don't know why we're not doing that on the radio now, because it really, really worked, and I had fun doing it with the music that I had to work with and the changing my voice and all that kind of stuff. So I had, so, and I would do poetry. I even did poetry by somebody, a lot of people don't even know who wrote poetry, Bernie Casey, who is one of our black actors, and this man is a Renaissance man. He does a lot of stuff. He also writes poetry, and I had some of his poetry, and I read some of it, and I would always get the right kind of music to play underneath, and I knew how to operate the boards, so I had a lot of fun doing that. And then one day, this young lady comes over to the radio station. She says, "You think you're the best poet in North Carolina, huh?" I said, "Why you say that?" I didn't say that. I never said, "You're always doing poetry. Like, you're the only one that can write." I said, "I never said I was." She says, I think I'm pretty good, but I never said I was the best." She says, "My roommate writes better than you." I said, "Well, baby, I don't know who your roommate is." And she had a loose leaf book about this thick with all these poems that were in plastic covering, with pictures that were cut out from Jet and Ebony magazine. This girl, not only did she write some great poetry, I remember the first poem I read was a little poem, and it was a woman, it was a black woman sitting at the table looking at a cup of black coffee. She says, "When I think of you, I think of you as my cup of coffee. Black, strong, and hot. Good to the last drop. No cream or sugar needed." I said, "Damn! Ooh, that's bad." And then she had another poem entitled Liberation Poem. "How you gonna liberate the rose without liberating?" Now, all these poems this girl wrote when she was like between 17 and 20 years old. I mean, because this is while she was at school. And she said, "How you gonna liberate the rose without liberating the violet? They both flowers. They grow hand in hand. How you gonna liberate the black woman without liberating the black man? They both black. They grow hand in hand. Black woman, can't you see that these woe man's liberation movements exclude you? You don't want to be liberated from your man. You want to be liberated."
Use that in your play.
That was the opening line of comments.
You're listening to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, the third and final part of our discussion with Abiodun Oyewole of The Last Poets will begin in just a moment. If you're curious about any of the songs or poems mentioned on this show, you can find lyrics, music, and annotations on rapgenius.com. Welcome back to the third and final part of our special discussion with Abiodun Oyewole of The Last Poets. We began by talking to him about the use of The Last Poet's poem, Black Rage, which he wrote on an episode of the TV show New York Undercover. Oyewole was concerned that the show's creators wouldn't let some of the song's more political lines make it to the air.
And in the last part, which I was really concerned about, because I flip it at the end and I said, "But these are warriors looking for a rites of passage. They're young lions enchanted by the sound of their roar. They are the beauty of spring surrounded by the cold snowstorms of winter." And every single word that I said on that particular track is said in the soundtrack of that particular episode. And I was very pleased about that. And it is a classic even today. And it's even more important. I mean, we consider like the month of August, 65 black kids got killed up in Chicago because they're having all kind of gang fights. And see, there's got to be, that's one thing I was hoping that Barack Obama could do that he hasn't really done. And that is recognize what Carter recognized. When Carter came in office, he recognized the problem that blacks were having in the urban areas. And so he hired Ernie Green, who was a Little Rock Nine person, and he hired him as the Secretary of Labor. And the first thing Ernie Green did, one of the first things he did, was set up recruitment training programs, which allowed young men to get training in carpentry, plumbing, electricity, whatever. But you make money in all of those gigs.
Yeah.
And if you get certification and you get into the union, you're good to go. You ain't going to be hitting nobody in the head or selling drugs or nothing else. You're going to do the right thing and you're going to be all right. And so that's the only way you stop the influx of prison like it is happening now, by having alternatives. And that has to come from the Labor Department, because our problem here is finances. In this world that we live in, you got to have dollars and cents to get it. And you got to have more dollars than cents. We're short on that right now. So Barack has got work to do, but I was hoping that he, because it's really about the people that he has working with him and around him. He can't do everything. So if you hire the right people, then maybe we can get the right job done, because we still have a void. We still got a big black hole in the earth of our youth with nothing to do. So if they don't have anything to do, if they have not given any, if there are no programs for them to be involved in that are going to help them get their act together, they'll create their own programs. They will create their gangs and they will roam the streets and they will be a problem. And we're going to see more grenades in their eyes all over the place, because unfortunately things are not good, and money is still king in this country.
Yeah, the thing about Black Rage that got me was the connections you drew about the violence on the street, mm-hmm. and the violence done by the state,
mm-hmm.
and in turn, like, the way the state, what the state does to its soldiers. You know what I mean? And the violence the state teaches its soldiers to do.
Yes.
Those different kinds of violence. And how did you make those kind of connections, especially with the returning soldiers? Was it people coming back from Nam that
Of course. I mean, and people coming back from the Nam, please, I've heard so many people tell me stories about the Nam, and then how, and it's so interesting, because it was during that time while Nam was going on, the last poets were hot. And I've had a lot of young men, countless young men, tell me about how I saved them, because they heard my album when they were in Nam, and they started getting themselves together. It made them feel a little bit more comfortable, because it was such an unglorious war. You know, people today don't even talk about Vietnam and Korea, but two wars that we did not win. I mean, this country got their asses whooped because we were meddling in family business, and because Vietnam was between the North and the South with the Vietnamese. And they already kicked the French out, and now here comes America, and we lost 55,000 soldiers. Totally unnecessary. But this country feeds off of war, it makes money off of war, and that was a problem. So I wanted to tie in as much as I could to point out the violence of the land and how this country forces it, and I think I got to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to ask you a couple more things.
Yeah, sure.
Wind down. I really appreciate it. We talked about this a little bit off camera as well, but the first Last Poets album uses the N-word a lot.
Right.
And I guess I was wondering how you felt about seeing just that part of the Last Poets be picked up by hip-hop.
It breaks my heart. It hurts my heart to think, because I really, when asked, we were interviewed in Sweden about this, or I forget exactly where, and I said, you know, as much as I hate it, I have to take responsibility, because we said nigga thousands of times, but we never said it in such a way for you to see it as a banner of something that you should wave. That was not the way we said it. We said, and I always break it down, so we said run nigga, like, you know, get out of here. We don't want you around. We said niggas are scared of revolution. If you're a nigga, you don't want to change. We said niggas are untogether people. We said wake up niggas. If you're a nigga, you're sleeping. You ain't even awake. I mean, we said a whole bunch of things. And then we went on and said, die, nigga, die. I mean, gosh, you can't get any clearer than that. I mean, you can call it metaphorical or whatever, but we really wanted it to end. The fact is that the only thing that the hip-hop artists heard was the word nigga. They didn't hear the other stuff. They didn't care to hear the other stuff. We never endorsed it as a term to use, but we use it. So I tell people now, I said, be careful of what you say, because it can be used against you. If it can be, then maybe we don't need to say it. So now, of course, the idea is to say things that hopefully will not be able to attach themselves to you and be turned around and used in a negative way, because that's what happened with nigga. If we did not plan to see a generation of our kids referring to themselves as niggas and praising the idea of being a nigga as something special. And to the point, when we went to Fez, Morocco, 3 years ago, we had a bunch of young people at the airport in Casablanca, and this one young man came up to me, he says, "Can I be a nigga?" And I said, "Oh my God." I said, "How about being a good Moroccan kid? Just be a good Moroccan." I said, a nigga's not what's happening. But he was saying it because they're influenced by hip-hop, and they hear niggas all the time, and they think a nigga is cool. And then, you know, maybe somewhere back in the line, the word had some relevance in terms of something that was important. I don't know, but the way the word was given to us and the way it was defined and deemed, it was to bring us down, to tear us up, and to make us look less than human and totally unsavory. So, we gotta work through that and have to just constantly remind people that, now, the latest, because I'm always lecturing and talking, I say, I don't tell people, die nigga no more. I say, just, since I know niggas are gonna be like roaches, and they're gonna be here forever, and I discovered there are all kinds of niggas, there are white niggas, there are Chinese niggas, there are Puerto Rican niggas, there's niggas of every race as a nigga. I said, so now I say CYN, control your nigga. Just control it. Don't let the nigga control you. Keep everything in check, because niggas can be unruly and irresponsible and real stupid. And if we have that kind of behavior, we'll never achieve the goal.
And obviously, sort of winding, we are a hip hop website. You know, deal with primarily hip hop lyrics and artists.
Mm-hmm.
You've called yourself, and the poets correctly, I think, said that you guys parented the hip hop generation.
Well, you know, people say that, and I appreciate that. And when I did talk with Kool Herc and African Bambaataa, I think it was Kool Herc that told me, and only said, "Man, the only thing we had to listen to back in the day was you guys." And hear you guys doing, like, I think he quoted Jones Coming Down, which was really interesting that he quoted that, because Jones Coming Down was the only piece on the album that was really freestyle. Jalal and I went to a shooting gallery. That's what they call the places where the junkies would go to shoot drugs. And we actually did research like scientists. We went in there. This is in a basement apartment somewhere in Brooklyn, I'm not sure, near Utica Avenue. I remember that. And we were in that place, and these folks come in there, and they look around, and they see us, and they would stop. And the guy that was kind of managing the place, he would give the nod that we were cool. They went on and about doing what they were there for, which was shooting up that stuff in their veins. And I saw some stuff I'd never seen ever. I mean, I saw people shooting drugs in their neck because that's the only healthy brain they had left. I saw, when I saw a guy pull out his penis and shoot the drug in his penis, I almost got sick. I got up. I actually got up from where I was sitting, and I went over to him. I said, "Yo," I said, "brother, what you doing, man?" I said, "What about your woman?" And my man looked at me. He said, "Man, this is better than any woman, man." And then that's when I said, "We are crazy. We're sick. That's gone outside completely." That morning, we stayed there all night and watched these brothers and sisters come in and shoot drugs. The morning came, and I don't know who was the first one to say it, but one of us said, "Day breaks." I said, "Got the shakes, joint dripping." The poem was freestyle, the whole piece. Jalal gets credit, because he was the rhyming genius in the group as far as I was concerned. I always rhymed. When I first wrote, I wrote a lot of rhymes, but he rhymed everything. He could rhyme a conversation. He could rhyme anything. But his rhymes made sense. He never used, just because he had cat, you're going to see fat. No, he'd always have it together, and he knew how to swing it. So that poem came about, like the hip-hop world talks about freestyle. Well, that was freestyled by both of us after having had that experience of watching our brothers and sisters shoot drugs in their body.
So finally, the last. I mean, I could talk to you for hours, and I hope to have you back.
It's cool, man. I'm enjoying it. It's fun.
And
it gives me a chance. You know, these kinds of things help me to reflect and just kind of take notice of where I've been and what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
Because you know, you can't really go where you want to go if you don't know where you've been.
Yeah.
And so I mean, I've done a lot of interviews, and sometimes it gets to be kind of like, you know, overmuch. Sometimes like this, because this is a comfortable environment. You're a comfortable guy. You know, you make it easier. It's not a rush thing. It's smooth. It's easy. And it gives me a chance to reflect and see some years that have I put in and make me realize that, I'm worth more than I even think sometimes.
We started when you came in talking about children and education, and the final thing I wanted to ask you, you've worked extensively with children over the years, teaching, writing poetry for children. I saw some of the poetry you wrote, you know, the poems about, you know, Harriet Tubman and Joe Lewis and, you know, King and X and all that kind of stuff, and leading poetry workshops for young writers. I'm sure you've taught young people a lot of things over the years, but what's something surprising you've learned from some of the children?
I mean, first of all, that we are a poetic people. We love poetry. I mean, one of the greatest gifts I think I can ever receive, or one of the greatest honors I will ever receive, is when I'm walking down the street. It could be in Brooklyn, the Bronx, Queens, or Harlem, especially because I'm there most of the time, and some kid comes up to me who has grown and saying, "Brother Doom, remember me from the fourth grade?" And I say, "Well, I don't really remember you because I don't think you look like that in the fourth grade. But do you still sing Daddy Joe?" And I say, "Yeah, let's sing Daddy Joe. Can we do that?" I mean, I've had folks, and that's the song I wrote about my father.
Yeah.
But it was such a powerful song dealing with my father that it became a song for a lot of people's fathers, even the ones that didn't have fathers. That song became important because I remember the first time I sang it, I had the kids just were patting their thighs and they were joining in on the chorus even before I told them to join in on the chorus. I have a pledge rap that I open up everything I do with, which was also freestyle, by the way. I told people, because I don't pledge allegiance to the flag, nor do I sing the Star Strangled Banner. But I was standing up in front being polite, but a little girl raised her hand, and about 1,500 people there. It was a graduation. I was a keynote speaker, and she raised her hand, and I called her, and I said, "Yes." And I was trying to be cool. And she said, "You didn't sing the Star Spangled Banner, and you didn't pledge allegiance." Oh, boy. So she threw me under the bus completely. And I said, "No, I didn't." And I just went on and said, "I didn't because this country has never pledged its allegiance to my people. And that song is a war song. It's insulting that they would tell you not to fight after you sing a war song." You know, and then some people started to clap, and they quickly stopped because they thought they might lose their jobs. The superintendent was on stage, and the principals and everybody. But I said, "Besides, I got a pledge that's much better than that pledge." And I didn't have anything. But I had my mind, and I had been wanting to write a new introductory piece. I had been doing this piece called Sun People as an introductory piece whenever I met with a bunch of kids. I always dropped something on them to let them know I wasn't a square. You know, I could hang and I could, you know, we could have some, we're going to have some good times. So some people was working, but I got bored with some people because after you do something 1,000 times, you know, you want something different. So I needed something new. That gave me my opportunity. And at that moment on stage, I created a pledge that now is used in Germany and France and in Switzerland, all over the world. I mean, this pledge has become so large, and I'm so very proud of it because it is a human pledge. It's a pledge for everybody. And it's because of my involvement with the kids, and the kids love it. I have had people stop me on the street and say, "Do you still do the pledge, brother?" I said, "Of course I do the pledge, because if you come to my house every Sunday before we do any poetry, matter of fact, I don't even have to say anything. One of the other people in the house say, 'We got to open up with the pledge, dude.'" My sons, there was some kind of tribute. I know it was being done to me. I thought it was just a regular poetry reading at the New Yorker about a month ago. One of my poet sisters named Eliza B. She's beautiful, absolutely gorgeous girl, and very smart and a decent poet. She had something at the New Yorker, but it was really like in giving thanks to what Abby Oduna has done in my life. And she testified, and then everybody else that came up there, Rainmaker and Brother Earl and all these other poets who are known, they started saying, when I first met Dune, and I'm sitting there, I said, God, man, what are they trying to do? Get me to cry? What is this about? I came down to share poetry and to be a part of this, and it's a tribute to me. This is insane. And then when they brought me on stage, my sons, both of my sons, one is a lawyer and the other is a teacher, they did the pledge. And my lady, she says, look at that. She says, they trying to take over. They got your pledge. They're doing the pledge. I said, it's okay. But it's the kind of thing that makes me feel very good, because it's just a small little nugget of stuff that we need. I want to be what I can be, to be proud, healthy. And I have to see, what I do, like when we're on the road, because now we do it as the beginning of all Last Poet concerts. I say, all right, I want you to open up. I said, we're going to do a little, oldest form of group participation known to man is call and response. So we're going to do a little call and response to get the show started. Are y'all down? Yeah, everybody's down. I say, I hear your words. Hear your 8-word response to my calls. Free, everybody say free, free, grow, grow, misery, misery, down, down, true, true, sad, sad, a lift, here, here. All right, now we're gonna rock, all right? I want to be what I can be, to be proud, healthy, and free. And if they're slow, I say, oh, come on, y'all retarded. We gotta get it better than that and to get the rhythm together. And then we go, I want to say what I know to help my brothers and sisters grow. I want to feel good about me and blame no one for my misery, cause I'll be strong to turn it around. I want to go up, I'm not going down. I want to do what I can do to make all my dreams come true. Remember my past, the good and bad, how I made it art, even when it was sad. I want to share whatever my gift, and when you're feeling low, I'll give you a lift. I want to live without fear, and know that I'm blessed for being here, and know that you're blessed for being here, and know that we're blessed for being here, and know that we're blessed. We did that at the school yesterday at Evansville Middle School, and when I was leaving, there were some kids in the hall. I did it one time. And there's kids who and it's, they didn't know it. So they were almost acting like Ella. Because this one kid was saying, I want to be. He was almost scatting it. But he was in the flow of it and the feeling of it. And I just said, oh, man. And I love it, because the idea, if you're a writer and you're trying to reach people, you want to write something that they can really use and that they can take and use again and again and again until they just wear it out. Because that's what I write for communication. I don't write to be in an ivory tower to get some kind of grandiose applause for having written something beautiful. I want you to use what I've written. I want you to take it and use it as medicine if you can. Because that particular pledge is something that came to me, and it came simply, and it made all the difference in the world. And I've even discovered how important it is, because there are certain times when certain verses will pop up in my own mind, like something that happened, then I'll even hear myself say, I want to feel good about me and blame no one for my misery, which is a very hard thing to do sometimes when people are late and not taking care of their job, you know. But you have to recognize that it's you're the only thing you can kind of bank on, you know, in many ways. And we can't continue, we can't throw stones just because we don't have our way. But I have a wonderful connection with the young people. I'm real, real, real proud of it. They are my basic source of inspiration and motivation for me to continue to do what I do. I know I would not be the person I am if I did not work with kids. Kids, that's like a part of me that I want to keep alive. So in keeping the child alive in me, I can only do that by working with young people. So that's the give and take.
That's That's wonderful. And so what is coming up for Abiodun and for The Last Poets?
The Last Poets, we have, we have the greatest documentary that's been done so far, and I even brought copies with me, but it's called The Last Poets Made in America with 3 K's, and it was done by a man named Claude Santiago, a Cuban brother, who really understood where we were coming from with the drums and all that, because, you know, the drums being the original voice, you know, the first AT&T, the first Verizon, you know, messages were sent through the drums. And so for us to use those drums with our words just makes all the difference in the world. And none of the other documentarians pointed out the drum as much as he did. And I love him for that. And then he did something else that blew my mind. At the very end of this documentary, he's got me, I'm singing God Bless the Child. And that's not a Last Poet piece, that's a Billie Holiday piece. And I'm singing it because it was supposed to have been the background for a poem written by David Nelson, which is called Soweto. And he was playing on the words and saying, so we too. And then the song God Bless the Child's Got His Own was supposed to be in relevance to that. Anyway, David's poem was much shorter than the song. And Felipe got upset because this is during the time we were doing the documentary. And he said, David, why do you have Doom doing a cover of a song? We're not a cover group. You know, he got him singing the whole song because I would be waiting for David to come in with his poem and he would just tell me to continue to sing. And the whole time that this was going on, there were cameras were on. And I didn't realize the cameras were on in the rehearsal room. I said, damn, I hope they weren't on in the bathroom too. I mean, you know, but Claude was getting all the footage that he needed to make this documentary. So when he started piecing things together, he decided to put me singing God Bless the Child, because I did sing the whole piece, and we had a band and everything, and they were playing, and I'm singing it. And I remember my partner, my cantankerous partner, he said to me, he says, well, baby boy, if you want a second job, you got it. He says, because I've been touched by what you did just now. And it was beautiful. And so I asked Claude before he passed, I said, why did you put me in there? And why did you have at the end with me singing, towards the end with me singing? He said, because that's what The Last Poets represented. You guys are a representation of having your own. You didn't ask anybody to do this. You didn't go to school for this. You just created a whole nother situation that everybody had to pay attention to. And now it's an institution, bro. He says, God bless the child. And I said, wow, Claude. I mean, I love Claude, man. He's a beautiful brother. So that's something that I've got copies of every time I go someplace and I've been selling. But the thing that I'm really looking forward to, probably more wholeheartedly than anything right now, besides the trip I'm having, getting ready to go to Senegal to do, I did a thing with a group over there called the Gobi System. Young boys, food, rap, and Wolof. And we did one album together. I did a couple of tracks. But this latest thing I've done with them is called Things Gotta Change. And it's really working really well. And I mean, I love their music. It's such a sensual kind of sound that they got going on. And I'm kicking my stuff in English. And I said, there will be a revolution. I'm talking about the change will take place. So I'm on there, and they've got a series. They got the American embassy and the Senegalese embassy to come together to do this American Senegal project. And I'm going to be touring all of Senegal in December and January. Actually, this is going to be the first time in 30 years that I will not be at the largest house party in the city, which I give every year, New Year's Eve. And I told my sons, I said, y'all got girlfriends, y'all are grown. Most of the people that come to the party are your friends anyway. Mm-hmm. Pops is not gonna be here. So y'all have 2 months to get it together.
New Year's Eve plans.
And it's some work involved, I'm not gonna tell you. I said, yes, I start cooking 2 days before New Year's Eve. I start getting stuff together because it's a serious, serious party. And the only thing I look forward to is the dawn. I want to see that sun come up so I can say, okay, let's everybody go home, because there'd be a crowd in that house. I mean, and I can't even fit 400 people in my house, but it's been counted. That's and let some people are just using 2 and 3 cups. I mean, I've had 400 cups go like boom. I mean, it's crazy. People are, it's become a tradition to the point where I don't know who's coming. People know that I have a large house party on New Year's Eve, and folks love to come out and celebrate. So that's a big deal. But this will be the first year I'm going to miss my New Year's Eve party. What's happening, though, for me this year, which I'm hoping will bring in great, just a lot of love. I have my first, this is an album out I have coming out, it's a solo piece, which is aptly entitled My Life. And I think it's the best thing I've done. I'm not going to say ever, but it's one of the best things I've ever done. And it's all the music was done by my grandson, and all the dressings on all the pieces is done by my son and his wife, who is a diva. She's a singing fool. And I'm so proud of the, well, my son said, I sent them to meet because they live in Fort Worth, Texas. He said, Pops, you sent us to meet. We just put the seasoning in it. That's all. He said, it was already ready. Yeah. Just needed seasoning. And I'm so proud of them because what I've heard that, you know, they sent me back, I was just, it's exciting. So I'm looking forward to pumping that up. And I have a little project, which could be a very, very big project, what I'm getting ready to unleash on the scene. I'm getting ready to probably put a little dent in Hallmark's business because I travel so many places and I take pictures all the time. And some of my pictures are pretty good. And I never give myself credit for being a photographer. I just like to take nice pictures. And I put in, when I take a picture that I really like that reminds me of the place I've been, if you come to my house, you'll see I have a wall in my study that's just full of pictures from all over the world. And some of those pictures have caused me to write poems. And so I've decided, my lady really decided, to take the poems and put with pictures and come up with cards. So now I've got this whole card collection that's off the chain. We went to Iguazu Waterfalls. Iguazu is a bigger waterfalls than Niagara Waterfalls. Iguazu is between Argentina and Brazil. And so I had a piece about, I had a picture of the Iguazu Waterfalls, and then I have a poem entitled Waterfall, and I sent that to a friend of mine down in South Carolina. She says, baby, your poem, she said, that card was like better than the air conditioning. She says, it was 105 degrees, and I came home and I opened my mailbox, and I got this card, Waterfall. She says, it just made me feel so good. She says, all I could do was get upstairs, take off my clothes, and jump into the shower. She says, baby, says it a poem. I just kept it right there so I could see it. Says, it's a beautiful picture. She says, who took that? I said, I took the picture. Says, whew, that's beautiful. But I'm into that. So I got this nice little card collection that I'm getting ready to put out there too, because I wanted to do something with the little poems. And, you know, poems I'm never going to really read in public. Poems that a lot of people don't even know I've done. But since I'm a poet and I take pictures, that's another marriage. And I'm enjoying that too. And that's been a fun trip. And plus, the people at Staples, I got some friends at Staples now, and they just work with me so well. It's beautiful. So, but I always try to keep something going on because I still got energy. I still got these ideas in my head. And I just want to be an example for something that's good.
Well, thank you so much for coming by, and it was beyond a pleasure. Legendary.
Well, Sean, I appreciate what you're doing, and if there's any other way I can be of any help, whatever, just give me a call, email me, whatever.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. Rap Genius is dedicated to decoding, annotating, and analyzing hip-hop lyrics. Join us next week when we talk to two of this show's good friends and returning guests, Gene Gray and Pharoah Monch, about their new project. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is hosted and written by Sean Sitaro, a.k.a. Same Old Sean. To make sure you never miss an episode of the show, please subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. You can reach me with your thoughts about Outside the Lines via Twitter. I'm at Same Old Sean, that's S-H-A-W-N. This interview was recorded by Nicole Otero. It was engineered by Brian Penny at the beautiful Three Egg Studios in Brooklyn, New York. Our show's intern is Sunny Kahara. Intro and outro music by Psionic, interlude music by Sir Loin. I'm your host, same old Sean, and I'll see you next week on Outside the Lines with Rap Genius.